I'd like to call to order the June work session of the Commonwealth Transportation Board and welcome all the attendees here on behalf of the Commonwealth Transportation Board. There's a very long agenda today and a number of very important issues. Before we begin the presentations, I know there were a couple of citizens who said they were unable to make it to the Thursday meeting, and they asked if they could provide some commentary prior to the work session. Are there any citizens here who would like to address the board who don't plan on doing it tomorrow morning under the normal customary time? Okay. With that, and before we get into the formal presentations, yesterday was a very important milestone in the stimulus program for the Commonwealth, and I'd like to ask Rita Buescher, the Chief Financial Officer, just to give a board an important update on that. Thank you, and welcome, Ms. Buescher.
I am extremely happy to report that ahead of schedule, we have obligated more than our 50% of the stimulus money. The due date was June 29th, so we have obligated through the FHWA $287 million as of yesterday.
Very good.
And the even better is we've advertised $246 million worth of projects and awarded $81 million to date.
Yeah. Okay. So, dirt is flying. Thank you, Ms. Buescher. And I would like to just share with the board, if you try and put the stimulus program in context, it's basically doing a second to six-year program on top of the normal one. It's about the same dollar value. And the three most important words in the development of the program, I think Mr. Sterling would certainly recognize this with his years in Washington, is by the book. And so these projects are being held to a very high level of scrutiny by federal highways, by the Federal Railroad Administration, and the Federal Transit Administration. And so this is a very important and significant milestone. I just want to say thank you to staff for making that a reality. Okay, we're going to pick up now with the agenda. And as I indicated, it is a very long agenda for brevity, so that brevity is rewarded. We want to leave a lot of time for a discussion on the budget issues on items number 7 and 8. Our first item is an update on high-speed rail in Virginia. Welcome, Mr. Badger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Last month, a request was made that we give a presentation on high-speed rail, so that's what I put together. This will talk about the existing and future high-speed rail networks in the country and in Virginia, talk a little bit about the funding, and then wrap up with key points regarding the outlook for passenger rail in Virginia. This map shows the rail passenger network in the United States. The gray lines are the regular Amtrak lines. The red lines are the 10 high-speed rail corridors that have been designated by the Federal Railroad Administration. When ICE-T was enacted in 1991, it called for the designation of these corridors. FRA designated the corridors in 1992, and then at our request in 1995, they amended the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor to include the spur that you see over to Hampton Roads. This is actually a map from FRA's strategic plan that was released in April of 2009. The blue corridor you see up there is the Northeast Corridor. And if you look at Virginia's strategic position, we are at the northernmost end of the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor and the southernmost end of the Northeast Corridor, and that's very significant for Virginia. Amtrak has stated repeatedly that they want to see the Northeast Corridor extended from Washington down to Richmond. And that would mean that Richmond would be connected to the only high-speed rail corridor in operation today. This is a picture of the fastest train in North America, the Excel Express. It runs between Washington, D.C. and Boston, travels at 150 miles an hour in a number of segments, and otherwise the top speed is about 135. Amtrak has a fleet of 20 of these trains, and they've carried more than 10 million passengers since they began revenue service back in 2000. As you can see, the Northeast Corridor is electrified. This allows for both greater energy efficiency and faster trains. And if you've ever traveled by train from the Northeast Corridor down to Richmond, you'll remember that when you got to Union Station in Washington, D.C., there was a significant delay, and that is caused by the need to switch the engine out. They have to get rid of the electric locomotive and bring in a diesel locomotive. So Amtrak's proposal to extend the Northeast Corridor down to Richmond also includes the idea of electrification. And if they do that, that would remove a bottleneck that we have at Union Station today. Now, that does not mean that we're going to have 150-mile-an-hour trains coming to Richmond. 90 miles an hour is the best that we can hope for in the foreseeable future. But with 90-mile-an-hour trains, we ought to be able to get a 90-minute trip between Washington and Richmond, and that is something that would be very highly desirable and I think very well patronized. This is the map of the Northeast Corridor. Again, this is the only place where high-speed trains operate today. It's also the busiest corridor in North America. More than 2,600 trains, both passenger and freight, are operating over some portion of the D.C. to Boston route every day. In 2008, there were just under 11 million passenger trips taken in the Northeast Corridor, and that's more than a third of the entire Amtrak system. Between Washington, D.C. and New York City, Amtrak now carries more people than all of the air carriers combined, and they account for about 14% of all passenger trips, including automobiles, between Washington and Boston. So this is really the mother lode of rail passenger service in the United States, and we are at the southern tip of it. And if you look at the map at the very bottom, you'll see a little fork just as that points just south of Washington, D.C. Well, here's that fork again. These are our two new state-sponsored Amtrak trains that we've talked so much about in the past couple of months. And they are really Northeast Corridor trains that we are simply backing down into Virginia. We speak of these trains as Lynchburg to Washington and Richmond to Washington, and that they are, but in reality, they're Lynchburg and Richmond trains to Washington and Philadelphia and New York City and Boston. And that's one of the reasons why we think we're very confident these are going to be very successful. All right, now let's talk about the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor. Again, this is designated back in 1992, and the Hampton Roads spur was added at DRPT's request. This shows the entire corridor. The significance of the lines is very hard to read the legend there. The thin black lines simply show the rail line that has been designated by FRA. Those that are shaded in purple show where feasibility studies have been completed in terms of upgrading service. The solid red line that starts in Charlotte, goes to Raleigh, then all the way up to Washington, D.C., that signifies where an environmental impact statement was done and a record of decision was issued by the Federal Railroad Administration. The green line shows the segment, the Richmond to Hampton Roads segment, where DRPT is now conducting an environmental study. And the section that red with the yellow outline, that is the Raleigh to Richmond segment of the Southeast High-Speed Rail Corridor, where a Tier 2 environmental study is currently underway. And this is the status of that study. We've been working on this. North Carolina is taking the lead on this study, but we are working with them on this. A draft 2 EIS is anticipated to be completed in mid-2010, and they're hoping for a record of decision from FRA in late 2010 as well. After the record of decision, the project will move into preliminary engineering, final design, and construction. North Carolina is predicting right now that service could begin as early as 2018. Now, our own EIS down in Hampton Roads, we have been conducting an environmental study for passenger service between Richmond and Hampton Roads starting back in 2004. We are working with FRA to wrap this up. But I can share some of the findings from the preliminary study. The study identifies five alternatives. Three of them are build alternatives. One would have service on the peninsula operating at conventional speed, which is 79 miles an hour, and then build high-speed rail service on the south side, both at 90 miles an hour, and we're also looking at 110-mile-an-hour service. The second option would build high speed on the peninsula, both at 90 and 110 miles an hour, and build conventional rail passenger service on the south side. And then a third alternative would build high-speed rail only on the peninsula, again looking at both 90 and 110 mile-an-hour service. The report, when we release this, will present the capital and operating costs. It'll talk about ridership and environmental impacts for all of the alternatives. The capital cost of the alternatives range from $330 million up to about $844 million, depending on which combination of alternatives or services you're talking about and what speeds the trains would operate. For Peninsula service, the report will show a relocated passenger station in Newport News, and then the trains will stop in Williamsburg on their way to Richmond. Southside passenger rail service would have a downtown Norfolk station and a Bowers Hill station in Chesapeake, and the trains will stop in Petersburg on their way to Richmond. And the cost of improvements between Richmond and Petersburg are included with the Southside numbers. Now, we've identified them separately so you could see what the cost between Petersburg and Norfolk is and Petersburg and Richmond. But we really needed to do that so we'd have comparable alternatives. It's really a Richmond to Hampton Roads study, not a Richmond or Petersburg study. Regarding ERA funds, the ability of any of these projects to receive that money, money that FRA has is available into 2012, and so depending on the schedule they select to disperse these funds, both segments could be eligible for funding. A couple of things that I can tell you about the study. One of the things that will jump out at you is the incremental time savings achieved by going 110 miles an hour versus 90 miles an hour are really not worth the investment. You don't save very much time, and it costs you a lot of money. And secondly, it's really apparent that reliable and convenient rail passenger service, even at 79 miles an hour, will be attractive to Hampton Roads residents. So I'm hoping when the report comes out, not too much attention is focused on the speed of the trains. And Norfolk Southern has expressed interest. They own the tracks on the southern route, and they've expressed an interest in having rail passenger service operated on the south side route, but they're looking at conventional speeds, not high speeds. So I'm guessing that when we do release the draft EIS, they'll submit comments and proposals to us to take under advisement. Again, we can't release the draft report until it's authorized by FRA. We're sending them one chapter at a time to try to expedite their review, and we hope to get the report released this summer and hold public meetings. After we hold the public meetings, receive public comment, DRPT will take that under advisement. We'll come back to this board with a recommendation about a preferred alternative. The CTB will make the decision regarding the preferred alternative, and then we will submit it to FRA for their review, and then look for them to issue a record of decision, hopefully in 2010. Of course, funding must be identified to advance into the next phase of environmental study after Tier 1 EIS and ultimately to operate service, so there's still a lot more to be done. Now here's a list of all the passenger projects that we have in our plans. This is pulling from the state rail plan that we released last summer. Our top priority for passenger rail projects is going to be service between Richmond and Petersburg and Washington, D.C., trying to get trains up to 90 miles an hour. There will be segments where they don't go that fast in Ashland and between Petersburg and Richmond where they'll operate at conventional speeds. We, of course, will have our high-speed rail service down to Hampton Roads, depending on the alternative selected for that. We've got commuter rail improvements. We've got improvements we still want to make in the I-81 and 29 corridor. And then there's the segment from Petersburg down to North Carolina Line that's part of the Southeast High-Speed Rail. So all of this totals up to about $3 billion, so there's no shortage of projects. In terms of our top priority, again, we are looking at projects between Washington and the Richmond-Petersburg area. We've got about $1.5 billion worth. We've got them broken into several categories there. Nearly all of these involve adding capacity to the rail line so the trains can get around each other and operate at higher speeds. Down at the bottom, you'll see track curve geometry crossover and signal system upgrades. Those are the improvements that really allow the trains to go 90 miles an hour versus 79 miles an hour. But you can see that the vast majority of the cost involve capacity and congestion improvements. Now, it's from this list that we'll be, we hope to be applying for the stimulus funds. Let me talk briefly about that. If you'll remember, the ERA funds, when they were announced back in February, contained $1.3 billion for Amtrak, $8 billion for high-speed rail. And as I mentioned, the funds will be available until 2012. In the president's budget, he's also committed to provide an additional $1 billion a year for each of the next 5 years for high-speed rail. And he's identified the development of high-speed rail as a very high national priority. The strategic plan that was issued back in April talked about projects, corridor programs, and planning. Projects that are ready to go would be ones that are so-called shovel-ready. Corridor programs are a little bit more long-term, developing of the high-speed rail corridors. And then the planning, there's a lot of states that are just now getting involved in the rail planning, so there's going to be funding available to help them develop state rail plans and advance projects into environmental review and then into construction.
Mr. Chairman, on that corridor issue, could I ask a question? I notice in almost all of the focus is in the highly populated areas, which is appropriate, but one of the highly populated areas that there doesn't appear to be even any conversation for corridor programs is across Northern Virginia, where there's such heavy traffic moving from the western part of the Commonwealth to D.C. And I wonder if that should not at least be on the discussion table to address that corridor's growing problem. Are the numbers such that it doesn't fit at all?
Well, what FRA is looking at is intercity passenger rail, and what I think you're describing is more of commuter rail. FRA does not get involved, and in fact, none of their money can be used for commuter rail. It's strictly for intercity passenger Amtrak-type service. So they're looking at the long haul. They're looking at least, you know, city pairs that are 100 miles apart, typically, and going up to 500 miles. So their focus is very different from the commuter shed of Washington, D.C.
But the statewide rail plan does include extensions of commuter rail service, and the corridor that you described is a potential expansion for VRE, which there is money in the statewide rail plan to do that. There are discussions now, though, between VRE and the Commonwealth and the localities. The next step is to get from Manassas to Gainesville. It's very expensive and one that's under some debate in the region.
The reason I raised the question is that old question about whether or not you invest in sort of future-looking planning so that you lay out a corridor that people don't completely build out so that you can get through that corridor and not have the problem that you have getting to Gainesville. And it seems to me that I'm glad to know the distinction because that helps me understand better why it's not on any list. But there are probably two or three like that that I think should be considered as we shift priorities to rail.
One other related issue, Assistant Secretary Donahue is working on changes to the urban development area so that where there is station development, there would be a requirement for adequate density to take advantage of the rail network, and that's going to be built into the rail and the land use program and the VTRANS document.
Thank you.
Regarding key dates, this morning, FRA released the guidelines for applying for the ERA funds. They came out around 11 o'clock, and we believe Kevin Page has an earpiece, and he's listening in on a conference call with the states right now explaining these guidelines. With 67 pages of Federal Register, I can tell you that they're a little bit about it. They're going to have something called a pre-application, where we'll be providing some basic information on the projects that you're thinking about. Those are going to be due by the 10th of July, so there's not a great deal of turnaround time. The applications themselves will be due by the 24th of August, so they're on a pretty tight timeline. That's for what they call projects that are ready to go, and also there's an opportunity to get some planning funds. Service development programs, which is more of the corridor development, the applications for those funds will be due on the 2nd of October. So we will, that's probably where we'll be focusing most of our effort, and so we will have until October 2nd to get our applications in. They have extensive list of information they want, and we are already got a lot of that together, so I think we're pretty well positioned to submit our applications. Again, there's $8 billion available in the ERA funding and $5 billion a year, $5 billion over each 5 years in FRA appropriations. This is not a whole lot of money. I showed you 10 high-speed rail corridors. They're all in various stages of development, but that money could be spent easily 10 times over in what the various states would like to do. I do think, even though we're competing nationally for these funds, I do think we have certain advantages. We have our framework agreements in place with the railroads. We've signed the agreement with Amtrak for state-sponsored rail service. We have a state funding program for rail, somewhat unique in the United States. And the projects that we're talking about, especially that $1.5 billion between Richmond, Petersburg, and Washington, doesn't involve much right-of-way. So that makes it a lot easier, less environmental impact, and easier to get that kind of project going. We have a very close working relationship with CSX, Amtrak, and FRA. We've been talking about these projects in the 95 corridor for months with them, so there will be no surprise. But finally, I want to end on one thing that's going to be very important. One of the things FRA is looking for, if they're going to be investing in high-speed rail and we're looking at adding trains to Virginia, they want to see a dedicated source of funding for rail passenger operations. It's something we've talked about before. It's something that we're going to be pushing for as we go through our demonstration program. With that, I'll be happy to take any questions.
Questions for Mr. Badger.
Ms. Conley. Are there any states that do, or are you familiar with many states that do have a special dedicated fund for passenger rail? Some of the Northeast corridor
yes,
states?
Yes, there are a number of states that do fund intercity passenger service, but certainly not the majority. Kevin, I don't know if you know the number. We're 15. There are 15 states.
That have a dedicated revenue
yes.
source.
There's 15 states that sponsor Amtrak service. We don't have a dedicated source, mm-hmm. but they do. So, I mean, there are 15 states that are paying for Amtrak service today, and we're one of the 15. We have demonstration funds. We don't have a dedicated source.
We have a dedicated source of capital to purchase
exactly.
public benefits. To realize the benefit of that, we're going to need also a dedicated source of operational funding, whether that's commuter rail, intercity rail, high-speed rail. And I would argue for the competitiveness of the port, there may be some instances where it's cheaper to subsidize moving freight operationally than building expensive additional highway infrastructure. Very important set of issues. Other questions for Mr. Badger?
Just a quick observation, Mr. Chairman. Italy announced the other day that for $1.3 billion they're launching new train service between Rome and Milan. That is about the equivalent of Richmond to New York City, 2 hours and 50 minutes service for $1.3 billion. And I know that things aren't exactly comparable between here in New York and Rome and Milan. But I don't know how different they are either. And at some point in the future, I think it might be helpful to find out what it is about what they're doing between Paris and Brussels and Rome and Milan that we are still so far behind, and I guess I'm not giving up until we can think larger and faster and whatever it takes to get that sort of thing done if we possibly can. I want to commend the DRPP for the progress of the last 2 years. We were sitting around wagging our fingers 2 years ago. Now we're actually talking about real money and real improvements, but I just want to point out we still have a ways to go, and I'd like to see some sort of sense of what the issues are that hold us back from getting where other countries are.
That would be a very interesting discussion. I'm sure we can arrange that, but very simplistic terms, the U.S. has the most efficient freight rail network in the world by far. The European and other countries have a weak freight rail network and have concentrated their rail development on the passenger side, kind of a simple comparison, and obviously that varies country by country. Okay, any other questions or comments? Thank you, Mr. Badger. And there was a point in there that I hope the board understands, that a decision is going to come back to this board, that a little bit like a normal NEPA document, we will recommend or select a preferred alternative. The final decision in these matters, particularly with respect to the Hampton Roads spur, will be made by the Federal Railroad Administration, but based on a recommendation from this group, and that'll come late this year or early next, correct? Okay. The next item on the agenda is the Enhancement Program Proposed Policy Changes. Welcome, Mr. Estes.
Thanks, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I actually have three brief presentations for you today. We'll be very brief because I want to hopefully spend a little bit of time on dialogue. The first two are policy changes, and the last one's project related. The first one is based on the enhancement program, as the chairman mentioned, and we always kind of go back and reflect on the enhancement program that this board is very familiar with. We always start with the mandatory set-aside. Again, this is a requirement that we spend this money on these type of projects. There are 12 eligible categories, and although it may be small in dollar amounts, you know, about $15 to $20 million a year, I think everyone here can appreciate the large interest from our localities, from the special interest groups, and large amount of time that you spent on it. We appreciate that. I know Mr. Davies mentioned last night even he was at a meeting till about 10 o'clock on one of these projects. So we do recognize it takes quite a bit of your time, but I know your applicants are appreciative of it. A real quick overview of the program. Again, I feel like I'm preaching to the choir. You guys know this probably as well as anyone. We do consider all eligible projects. This is based on the CTB's policy from 2003. We score those through an application process, both existing and new projects. We limit their requests typically to $1 million. And one of the important policies that was put in place in 2003 is that we require that we allocate at least 25% of what they request. That's important. We'll talk about that here in a second. Typically, we receive 150 to 200 projects a year, and we allocate to about 100 projects. Kind of this slide presents a little bit of the health of the program, kind of where we are. Since its inception back in 1993, we have a little less than 800 projects in play. You can see the number that have been completed. I want to focus on what's out there still, which is about 420-some projects that are existing, whether they're under construction, maybe one piece or a phase of a project, or whether they're in project development. Although, again, the board, I think, made a very wise and aggressive decision back in 2003 to put that 25% rule into play, we still do have somewhat of an issue in Virginia about the inability to bring some of these projects to fruition based on the large funding requirements that are sometimes associated with them. And you can see where we stand on that. We've taken some fairly aggressive moves over the last 2 years. Again, you're very familiar with this. Many of you have had the deallocation projects in your districts where we've taken a look at inactive projects or projects that have been completed to make sure we're moving any money that's available off of those projects to other projects in your districts. And you can see basically out of this year, the program level that you'll be approving hopefully tomorrow, about $2.2 million of that allocation was based on this deallocation process. So we have been able to free up some of that money through that process. The real meat of what we want to talk about today is the proposal in front of you in the next slide. And what we're presenting is really an emphasis on trying to even more aggressively focus on completing these projects that are in play right now and are existing projects, try to get those to completion. And then we'll talk very briefly about, similar to what we did with the stimulus projects, again back to the Enhancement Stimulus Fund, where we as a board, you as a board, focused that money on core transportation projects, a small number of projects, and projects with tourism and economic development aspects associated with those. So really the policy proposal that we're presenting today for discussion is just something to help get these projects closer to completion in a more timely manner. So here are the details. What we're looking at, and this is again just our proposal to you, is that as the reminder of the way the allocations are distributed, it's distributed over 15 equal shares, 9 district members, and then 6 at-large and the chairman Our proposal is that the district members would fund existing projects only. Again, after this tomorrow's allocation, it'd be about 450 projects in the pool, and add a minimum of 50% request instead of the 25% request. Again, that would be to get these projects kick-started more and get them to completion quicker. Our proposal is then, second level, is that the secretary and the at-large members would focus, similar to what we did with the stimulus money, large existing or potentially new projects that focus on that core transportation function that was in the previous slide, the bike ped facilities, tourism-type projects, streetscape-type projects, things tied to the core transportation. And then the other thing that we'd like for the board to consider is to potentially look at a two-year application cycle. And what this would do would be to bring a larger pool of money that could be applied to a narrower set of projects. We're not proposing that we not accept applications this year. We would accept applications, again, at the end of this calendar year and potentially roll that two-year application cycle then after that. And, of course, I think what's worked very well, and we'll let the at-large members just really be the judge of this, is staff recommendations. Again, our staff really knows, as a lot of you know, where these projects stand and the ones that are really moving. So with that, what our proposal is fairly aggressive. At a discussion today, I'd like to hear, of course, feedback. We plan to be very aggressive over the next few weeks on outreach efforts. I've already personally called a few organizations that are going to be somewhat interested in this proposal. And one of the things that I think, if it didn't jump off the page at you, for example, this board has done a very good job focusing not only on core transportation, like bike, pedestrian, streetscape-type facilities, but also historic preservation. So we've proactively tried to get in front of that a little bit and let some of those groups know that this is at least being in front of the board today, so I would expect you'll hear some more about that. And we would do a little more formal outreach after today based on today's workshop to those organizations as well as folks like Bike Walk Virginia and others like that. And it would come back to you in July with some of the results of what we've heard over the next month, and then potentially ask you for a resolution of support of changing the policy at that time. As we do every year, we have applicant workshops with those who potentially would be applying for the money. We're looking to have those in late July and early August. And the application deadline, we normally have it in November 1st. Based on what we're proposing, we've kicked that back a month in our proposal. And we do think there are some districts that, even though we have about 450 existing projects out there, we think there are plenty of good projects the board's already selected that we can focus our energy on. But there are some that potentially could get some of those off quicker than other districts. So we do think we obviously need to revisit this after the next 2 years to see how we're doing and maybe potentially ask the board for another change at that time. So with that, I think that's my brief presentation on the program.
Thank you, Mr. Estes.
Mr. Chairman.
Mr. King.
Mike, wouldn't the two-year application cycle add to your problem of drawing down the allocated funds? Because you'd have a year's... You're not solving any of your problem that you've got with your allocations, are you?
Well, I think it could. That's a potential point. I think, Mr. King, Mr. Chairman, what we look at it as is almost like a two-year budget, where that applicant would see they've got a fairly large remaining balance to get that project completed. They may not get it all up front in 1 year, but they show that over the next 2 years they can fully get that project to completion. And that, if anything, in our experience, that helps them move quicker to see that they've got that money that's going to get them to the end and not just another piece of the puzzle and they're not sure how they're going to get to the final stage of a project. So that was our thinking on that. Is that it's also, to be blunt, it's a administrative burden on workshops, application scoring, those kind of things that we're looking at, just trying to see how we can streamline the entire program.
Mr. Chair, Mike, isn't it possible we could speed up the locals, the recipient of the grants, by possibly changing the application, setting some timelines on expenditure in which they have to really expend it, or that it's automatically come back into the, reverted to the fund. That way you put the pressure on them and we don't have to coordinate the thing all the time. So you use it or lose it. And here's the deadline. And if not, then it goes back to be reallocated.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keene, that's a great point. One I failed to mention earlier was that with the board policy change in 03, we did put a four-year time limit on them. So we do have that in play, and that's a great tool. I think we're just trying to be completely blunt, a little more aggressive to try to move those forward.
Mr. Witt.
Mr. Chairman. Mike, is there any reason legislatively or by regulation that you have to parse this out between the district and at-large representatives the way you do?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Witt, good question. There's nothing in law that tells us. That's a board policy. That was, again, discussed back in 03 that there would be a 15-portion distribution.
If I may suggest this for future discussion, clearly the enhancement program has been one of the most enjoyable things that we do. When you have no other money to spend, even little dollars seem like fun. But that being said, I don't know that this is the most efficient way, and I think the CTB members are spending a lot of time on what does amount to very, very small amounts of money compared to other places where we could be focusing our time. I would suggest that we just create a committee of the at-large members and let that committee as a whole.
Is there a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I move.
There was no levity in the suggestion, so I was going to respond.
Is that a parting shot or what?
One of many. I would suggest it would be far more efficient to just move it to a smaller group and handle it as a whole. You and your staff do a great job of scoring these things and providing the information. And at the end of the day, looking at it on a statewide basis and getting the projects complete would be the best use of both our funds and our time. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Witt. And the chair would simply observe, about 4 years ago, you said, look, we've got to bring projects to fruition. Let's get rid of all these past balances. And the current financial situation has caused that to occur. So board members, take heed on this. We may get here by choice or we may get here by default. So I think there's some merit to what Mr. Witt says. Mr. Sterling and then Mr. McCarthy.
In your proposed guidelines or policies, you've got where 50% would need to be, instead of going 25% of the request amount, go to 50% of the request amount. But you've also got the two-year recommendation in there. Are you suggesting that it's 25% per year? Is it 50% per year so it gets fully funded in that two-year period? I'm trying to...
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sterling, our proposal, we didn't get into that detail, would likely look to where it would be 50%. But we may increase the dollar amount they could ask for because it's over 2 years. For example, right now we only allow them to ask up to $1 million. But if it's over a two-year period, we may have to up that. But it would still be 50% of whatever they requested.
So they could theoretically, let's just double it. They could request for a $2 million project. They could request $2 million. And we would have to fund at least 50% of that request for that two-year period, so $1 million of that if we're going to fund that project.
Yes.
Okay.
Mr. McCarthy.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Mike, I like what Mr. Keene had to say about focusing even harder on some of these projects. It's been 6 years since we adopted the four-year completion rule, so I guess before next month, would it be possible to get a list of anything that is currently delinquent? Because I would rather see us meet the four-year completion target, and if 4 years from the time of the award, if it's not done, unless there's some strange, you know, like a hurricane damage issue or something like that, I'd be inclined to push harder on that rather than doubling the size of the award and, you know, going up to $2 million and 50% of that. I mean, there won't be funding very many projects at that level.
That's true.
That's okay.
Okay, Mr. Bowie?
Chairman, is the proposal that the board adopt a policy recommending the existing projects only and recommending that any grant be at least 50% of the application, is that proposal of a mandatory policy or a recommendation?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Bowie, our vision of how this would potentially roll out would be we would send you a draft resolution in your next board package that would basically, like, for example, the 25% rule, that's in the CTV policy today. We would change that to 50%. And if the board, based on, maybe we'd ask the board to submit some, you guys have done well with sending me emails on your thoughts on different things, or we can talk, and we can come back with, if the board is supportive of focusing on existing projects for district members, I would like to put that in the policy. Similar to how we have the 15 split, 15 ways, that's in the policy. So whatever we would decide to do as a board over the next, whatever time frame we decide to do this over, I would like to put that formally in a policy. Yes, sir.
At the end of the day, it's a decision of the board.
I would much prefer to see it a recommendation that the district members try to get 50%, but not less than 25%. And likewise, that the strong priority be given to existing projects as opposed to any new ones. But I'd hate to see the district members cut out of the discretion to adopt any new projects.
Okay. Any other questions or comments on on this item? If you have additional comments or concerns, please send them to Mr. Estes, and you'll come back in July with a formal recommendation, correct?
Okay.
And the next item is a discussion of the economic development access policy.
Okay. Real quick overview of the Economic Development Access Program, and then we'll again walk through, I think, probably a little easier proposal, I hope, on what we've got for some recommended changes for that program. Kind of a flashback to 2006 when this board adopted the current policy on economic development access. Some of those who have been around a little bit longer, they used to be called the Industrial Access Program. That was really the change in 06, based on some work that we did with a stakeholders group. We really transitioned the program from the traditional industrial program to more of an economic development program, recognizing, you know, move towards corporate headquarters, things that you see here, research and development, and tying it into the Virginia Economic Development Partnerships, the definition of a basic employer. So that has helped move the program in that direction. And that policy, just again as a review, that the board adopted, also talks about not only what's eligible and what the focus of the program is, but it goes into detail about what also is not eligible for the program. I won't spend a lot of time on that. But again, this is also in the policy where it's the expectation that any roads, access roads we're talking about that we fund through VDOT based on board approval, becomes part of a public system, whether it's the urban or secondary system. It's the expectation from the board's policy that local governments are going to take care of the land acquisition and utilities that are necessary for these projects. Of course, we're going to expect support from the local governing body. And again, there are two types of access programs under the road access, and those are traditional, where you have a named industry moving into the locality, or where you have a speculative type project where a locality is building a economic development park and is trying to market that facility to bring development in. That's what we call our bonded program. This program is blended with rail access as well as airport. It's $5.5 million a year. The current stipulations in the CTV policy is the maximum allocation unallocated is $300,000 per project with $150,000 matched. It also has a contingency in there that documentation for capital investment has to be at a 10-to-1 ratio. That was approved back, again, in that 2006 policy. But the above on the allocations and the capital investment, those stipulations really haven't changed since 1980. And that's our focus of the proposal in front of you. And this is really the kind of the indication of why we're in front of you. The red represents road access, whether it be airport or economic development, and the blue represents the rail access. And you can see over the last 6 years or so, five of those 6 years have been below average on the road access fund, about what we've allocated. So what we're trying to do is take a proactive approach, recognizing that, and trying to encourage more participation from the local governments with this program. We'd like to see more of these projects in front of the board on a regular basis. So in order to do that, we have two proposals that we'd like to bring back to you next month. One would be to increase that maximum allocation from the $300,000 unmatched to $500,000, and then have an additional $150,000 that could be allocated on a matched basis. We took a look at 20 projects since March of 2006, and really you can tell just by the increase in project costs, since this was set in, a large percentage of those are going to be over a $300,000 or the current level. So we do think that will make an impact. On the capital outlay requirement, we're proposing that we reduce the ratio from a 10 to 1 to a 5 to 1 to give a little bit more flexibility to our local governments, reduce the risk for payback. Right now, if you've heard from some of our localities, there is a real risk to low, payback on some of these projects, especially on, the speculative type development projects. And we propose that we focus that ratio only on the state dollars, the board allocated amounts, whereas previously we had also applied that same ratio to the local side of the match. You'll see that in my example here in just a second. We took a look at 45 bonded projects that are from 98 to 03. Again, we've got the bonded, you have a four-year period to document that capital investment. That's why we go back a little ways. And then we have a two-year window beyond that in policy. And about 12 of those would have benefited from the change that we're proposing here. So really, in summary, this is what this slide hopefully does, is trying to give you an overview. If you have a $600,000 project that comes in front of the board, current policy, we can allocate $300,000 unmatched. We can match another $150,000 to get to the $600,000 total project. We require then the locality to document $6 million of capital outlay and investment. Under the proposal that we'd like to bring back to you next month, we would provide $500,000 unmatched, only require $50,000 in match from the local government, and then when you apply the 5-to-1 ratio, would only require $2.75 million in capital outlay investment documentation. So what I'd like to do again is hear some feedback, hopefully bring this back to the board next month, and then we would update our guide that's associated with this policy subsequent to that in the fall.
Mr. McCarthy,
this is basically a grant program of some kind, isn't it? Because, I mean, with our funds being so squeezed, it's counterintuitive what you're proposing. I would think we'd want to increase the matching requirement rather than decrease it. It's putting more of a burden on the state with a limited supply of funds. We're going to wind up doing half as many projects as we're able to do, when if the demand for them is growing, you would think we'd try to figure out how to induce more people to put up more money rather than go in the opposite direction. So that's my concern with your proposal.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. McCarthy, just a quick response on that. I do agree that if the demand were to increase, you could potentially see a higher competition for the money. Unfortunately, with today's climate, we're not seeing the competition under the current rules. And we do agree that potentially if this does encourage, you know, a tremendous increase in the use of this money, that we may have to go back and change some of the requirements again. But right now, based on the state law and the code setting aside the $5.5 million every year, we're not seeing the ultimate utilization of that money.
Well, how are we doing this year?
How are we doing this year? Let's see if I can go back to this chart, I'll tell you. You can see on, I'm not sure if this is going to work, last column here, if you can't read it in front of you, is 2009. So we've taken the assumption of what you're hopefully going to approve tomorrow, either through rail or through road. And you can see we've only allocated $750,000. For road this fiscal year.
Out of how much?
Well, again, it's a combined pot, so there's $5.5 million total. So you can see there's $2.5 million to rail, and about $750,000 to road. So it's
so
$3.75 million.
Allocate all $5.5 million.
Yes, sir. That's my point.
Does that carry forward?
It does. Yes, sir.
And we're trying to push rail, right?
We are, and you can see that rail has done fairly well and has increased over the past few years.
All right, I'll certainly consider what you have
to say. Ms. Connolly, and then Ms. Cooley.
Just a clarification. What is in the documented capital outlay requirement, is that purely private sector dollars, or does that include the local share? What makes up that 10-to-1 or 5-to-1 ratio?
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Connolly, that's private investment. Yes, ma'am. The locality does not get credit for their local match that they've put up for this.
And so this would significantly lower the private sector contribution. I mean, they get a lot more for their $500 or $5 million or whatever.
And again, one of the points with that is, as we've changed from the industrial type development where it was very capital intensive, mm-hmm. We're trying to go towards where you might have a more of a softer cost. We do want to make sure that there's still capital investment required because it is very much tax-based what the locals are looking for. So we didn't want to just wipe that away. But we wanted to recognize that the transition of the industry that we're seeing participate in there has changed as well.
So could I follow? So you're seeing much less intensive industrial development and less sort of value-added type?
Right. And that
they may not have the capacity to meet that 10-to-1.
That was, Ms. Connolly, one of the points when we were trying to talk about the bonded projects that we had, and we looked about 25% of them had to give us money back. Even though they had an employer move into this economic development site, they didn't have enough capital investment to offset the 10-to-1 requirements, so they had to pay us back some additional funds.
Okay, Mr. Coolman, and then Mr. Sterling.
Thank you. Could you clarify for me, this is not a direct appropriation. This is an earmark of transportation trust funds, or how do you characterize where the money actually is set aside?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Coolmay, I'm trying to think if it comes from TTF or the Highway Maintenance Operating Fund, but it is in the Appropriation Act designated $5.5 million off. I would consider it off the top before it comes down to the formula that you would see in your book in front of you.
So that would mean, Mr. Chairman, then, that this is a pretty direct instruction from the Assembly to spend the money in this fashion as opposed to potentially use it in another way that might make more sense from year to year. Would you say the purpose of that instruction is really to stimulate economic development then?
Yes, sir. Absolutely.
So I have some of the same concerns Mr. McCarthy had about leveraging. I mean, it seems to be a time when leveraging more as opposed to leveraging less not only is in the state interest, but it potentially is boosting the kind of projects that aren't just marginal and getting shoved over the line by this type of assistance. On the other hand, would you say we negotiate each one of these deals uniquely? There's not really a template we lay over, even though we have guidelines here, but these things have to actually be negotiated out one-on-one, and each deal is slightly different than the next.
I guess, Mr. Coolman, from a negotiation standpoint, they are very specific, and it depends on, it's definitely usually a conversation between our residency and the locality on what is adequate access, what the county's trying to do out in this location, what would be eligible, what the county's going to have to put up and take care of on their end, what we're willing to fund through this program. So there is that negotiation there, but it's not the envision, I think, what you're talking about, where there's a leverage of, well, if the county's willing to put up this and you've got private investment of X, then the state's willing to put up Y.
And is this used primarily in a standalone fashion, or is it always a part of a larger package of incentives that maybe the locality and the state put together?
Majority, Mr. Coolman, of what we've seen in the recent history has been a mixed bag, whether it's opportunity fund, access fund. Most of the folks who are relocating, if it's a named industry, are going to have a mixed bag. If it's a speculative type site development, a lot of it's local money and this money, and I'm not aware of a lot of other avenues localities have to do that kind of speculative road construction.
Mr. King.
Mike, are most of these projects and awards made for locally sponsored administered programs, or does VDOT administer some of these? And the second part of that, what is the process? Do they have to put up all the money, complete the project, and draw down on it, And is that a hindrance to getting some of these projects underway? Okay. What is the policy? What's the procedure on that?
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Keene, that is a mixed bag. Some localities will do it themselves. We still do. You're going to see one in just a second in Frederick County that VDOT will be building. That's somewhat of the negotiation, I would say, up front. If we're building it and we're going to require the match, we can ask for that up front and make sure that's part of the negotiation up front, that we need all that money in hand. That really hasn't been an issue that I'm aware of for this program as to whether the locality builds the project, whether VDOT builds the project, or how the finances are handled. It's mainly been about how do they minimize the risk at the locality in case they are aggressive and try to build a speculative type economic development and aren't as successful as they thought they might be bringing in industry or new corporate offices or whatever they're trying to target.
Okay. Any other questions or comments? Mr. Sterling, I'm sorry, I didn't fail to recognize you.
I'd like to go back to the discussion on the capital outlay requirement, and I understand what you're saying in terms of you might be focusing on projects that's no longer the big factories or things of that nature as it may once have been. But do we have other ratios like number of jobs or the payroll level, other requirements that we're going to then also adjust or institute in order to sort of offset the fact they won't put in the capital outlays, but they'll require a certain number of jobs at a certain payroll level versus the median income in that general region?
Sure. Mr. Chairman, Mr. Sterling, we've had a lot of discussion about jobs. To be a little blunt, one of the things the Chairman has been encouraging me to consider is to try to tie jobs to this program more aggressively. And we looked at the Governor's Opportunity Fund, what they have. We looked at what Kevin has on rail. A lot of different things on jobs, and from a capital investment, and most of our projects are bonded over 4 years, the employment and how you track that over that time period and then the commitment beyond the 4 years makes that fairly cumbersome. What we have committed to do is be more aggressive on the number of jobs that we know up front, if it's a named industry that are coming, and the number of jobs that are coming at the end of that bonded period of what the locality was able to bring in. But we focus mainly on capital investment as our still our foundation category based on the way our bonded program is set up. So
if we focus it on the capital investment, but we've so dramatically reduced that requirement, don't we end up facing the very real prospect that we're going to use a considerable amount of the available funds? I mean, it's still only $5.5 million a year on projects which may not yield much both in terms of capital outlays or in terms of jobs or in terms of economic benefits through taxes and other things that would be derived.
Mr. Sterling, I think it's hard to predict from our end as to how fast this would spur on locals to take on more advantage of this program. But we do think that the reason we kept with capital outlay is, for example, if we went even further lower on capital outlay or even held that same but tied it to jobs or got rid of capital outlay, we were worried about, like, some of these folks have shell buildings that maybe a local government constructed for them and brings employees in. They've proven they've got the jobs at a certain level, but they've got the mobility. They don't have the capital investment to stick around. And so we were looking for trying to get a capital investment requirement that would also have a fixation in the community as well.
Okay. Do we find that the local communities are not participating? Is that why we're trying to increase by increasing?
Can I make a suggestion? We have a very crowded agenda, and those who have questions can follow up with Mr. Estes, Mr. Busher. I'll just conclude by saying this was done in conjunction with the Economic Development Partnership. This program was set up to attract heavy industry 20 years ago, 30 years ago. It needs to be updated. And the issue is more about jobs and less about fixed capital investment. That's just not the strength of Virginia economic development. And we would be blessed if this program were oversubscribed. This would be my parting shot. Let's move on to the next agenda item, please, and which is a SPIG industry, or excuse me, Frederick County Economic Development Access Program. Let's do these things very, very quickly. We have a very heavy agenda.
All right, real quick. Last one is Economic Development Access Program, as Chairman said, in Frederick County. It's basically the first phase of a 102-acre parcel. And you can see the improvements that we're talking about on the main road as well as the entrance road. to the facility. It's just north of Winchester, and you can see on the graph here that our proposal is to extend an existing secondary road after we improve it and provide adequate access to a bonded project in Frederick County. We will be bringing this to the board tomorrow, requesting the full allocation that we can request, $300,000 unmatched and $150,000 matched.
Any questions? Okay, the next item is Spig Industries, which is a rail industrial access grant proposal. And will this be on the agenda tomorrow or next month, Mr.
Next
Page?
Month, sir.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the board. I'll be very brief as we roll through this. This is the 30-day advance presentation for Spig Industries. Spig is down in Washington County outside of Abingdon. Spig is an expansion project. Spig actually manufactures guardrails that VDOT and other state and local governments use regularly for the protection of the highway systems. This project is a plant expansion which includes 18